Kathleen Johnston.
Alan Halls.
Question for you.
Go on.
Have we ever said the words Taylor Swift on this podcast?
I don't think we have.
I am in shock.
So, long time listening honeys will probably have noticed
a
that we're
absence.
Not Swifties. Everyone else is talking about Taylor Swift all the time.
Too much, perhaps.
But we're not. It's been a gaping silence in our cultural record.
Is it a political
decision?
Silence?
No. Okay, no. Guys, we'll level with you. It's just that we're not that fast. We're indifferent. I don't hate Taylor Swift. I don't love her. In fact, I have actually become somewhat more of a fan in recent years with her latest album. Prefer that to her older music. But I
Midnight.
Just don't get the obsession.
I feel you, babes. But before we get into this very juicy discussion, let's introduce ourselves. We always forget.
We do. We are Straight Up Podcast, the pop culture podcast covering all things fame, as well as TV, books, films, podcasts, you name it. We are looking at it.
And my name is Ellie. Your name is Kathleen.
We're besties and journalists. We actually met in 2016 at work. And for more on our friendship,
oh, we're doing a little bio
tuned.
Here.
Right, let's get into it.
So I'm from a quite interesting perspective, if I do say so myself,
yes.
In that I commission Taylor Swift content at an insane level. I am constantly commissioning and editing pieces about Taylor Swift because media brands are like literally driven by the Taylor Swift machine, I would say at this point.
So do the Swifties always go and read every single piece of content about her? Like, can you guarantee that the fan base are going to be supporting that piece?
No, and this is what's really interesting. I wouldn't even say our Taylor Swift content does like necessarily like better than other content.
Interesting.
The thing is that because she is such an integral part of the news cycle, as a newspaper, you can't ignore it. So
yes.
She is dominating politics and culture and society in such a way. And even now, like Hollywood, you know, the film industry is a big part of the Telegraph coverage. The way the Eras film topped the box office and like rewrote the rules of engagement at the box office, that
yeah.
was huge for us because it was like so novel. It was news. Essentially, everything Taylor Swift does becomes news.
Yeah, she's just like the forefront of the cultural conversation, whether that was the AI nudes recently.
Yeah. Or how Taylor Swift fans took Ticketmaster to court.
There was news a couple of weeks ago that I found absolutely wild, where a poll found that nearly 1 in 5 Americans believe that there's like a Taylor Swift Biden conspiracy. Did you see this?
Yes. Tell us more about it.
So there's this theory that Taylor is secretly plotting to help Biden win the election. And it's a kind of right-wing idea where they believe that the relationship with Travis Kelce is part of this bigger political ploy.
So interesting because, yeah, I would say that Taylor Swift, when she first started out because of her links to country music, was actually seen as kind of an emblem of the right. And she neo-Nazis were co-opting her.
Yeah, everyone thought she was a secret Trump supporter. And actually, I thought that she was probably pretty right-wing until I watched her documentary.
Miss Americana.
Yeah, and I have to say that's when, for me, my kind of perspective or feelings towards Taylor Swift really changed. I used to just, yeah, as I said, be a bit indifferent, maybe even verging on finding her slightly annoying. I'm not saying that's right. But when I watched that film, I was like, wow, she's actually this incredible artist that I just hadn't really given credit as a songwriter, as a woman in the public eye. And I found it so fascinating how she explains in the documentary that the reason that she wasn't political is because of what happened to the Dixie Chicks career.
Yes, and her dad as well. Again, not to say that her dad was a like malignant force, but it was her dad saying, absolutely do not speak up on that.
So guys, for context, the Dixie Chicks were basically kind of cancelled in 2003. And the term being Dixie Chicked has actually become shorthand for career suicide because they spoke out against George W. Bush and the invasion of Iraq. They ended up being blacklisted by many country radio stations. They received death threats and they were criticised by loads of other country musicians. Sales of their music and concert tickets declined. They lost corporate sponsorship. So it really negatively impacted their career being politically outspoken. And I think Taylor just didn't want to take that risk, knowing how conservative and right-wing a lot of the country music fan base is.
Absolutely.
Republican, I should say.
Actually, this is a massive sign of it. It's actually quite interesting what's going on with country music and at the moment, and that Nashville is becoming a lot more progressive. And there are lots of like progressive country music stars that are really at loggerheads with the more like right-wing, very problematic stars like Jason Aldean, who was the one that his song Try That in a Small Town went viral last year. Basically, the message of the song is if you come and disrespect a cop or like your protest impinges on our turf, you will be met with violence. Like, and that was seen as kind of maybe black protests being met with small town violence. And even worse, it was the video was filmed outside a building that had been associated with lynching in the slavery era. So people felt that that was like a very purposeful kind of symbol of what Jason Aldean stood for. But the controversy around that song just propelled him further into the limelight. He's huge. He's a huge country star.
Well, there's such an interesting debate going on within country music at the moment about whether it's, and I'm air quoting here, like a white genre or a black genre. And I think that's why it's so powerful that Beyonce has put a country album out now, because black people have been written out the history of country music and it's been co-opted by a white audience as if it's exclusively theirs.
So
whereas
true.
Actually the roots of country music are in African-American music.
As are the roots. I mean, even classical music. It's actually insane when you think about how, like, no music isn't.
Well, like, all music, yeah. Rock with Jimi Hendrix. Yeah. Every music, like, comes from the African diaspora, essentially. Yeah.
Anyway, back to Taylor Swift. So the reason I wanted to talk about her this week is because two things have developed that I have found very indicative of just how astonishingly successful she is, to the point where I genuinely think she is rewriting the rules of celebrity. Firstly, Taylor Swift has now a dedicated weekly newsletter in The Guardian called Swift Notes.
Are they just doing that to drive traffic, though, in the hope that they're going to really capture the Swiftie fan base?
I reckon that must be behind it. Yeah, I would assume that maybe The Guardian has a younger audience at Telegraph and maybe their Taylor Swift content does better than ours. But
I wonder if they're actually Guardian readers, though, or if this is an attempt to bring in readers that otherwise wouldn't be going near The Guardian.
Very good point. I also do wonder if there's a way, if it's because maybe doing constant Taylor Swift content is annoying the core audience, and this is a way of putting it, packaging it all in one area. Because I could imagine that the constant Taylor Swift content is potentially annoying the Telegraph audience, and it would be useful if it could be put in one dedicated channel that would only service people who really want it. And as news feeds are becoming so much more personalized now anyway, that is essentially really the future of news. So that's a fact one. And they describe it as, during this year of turbo Swift activity, new music, the UK leg of the Eras Tour, her influence on the football field and the US presidential elections, here's your ticket to Taylor World. I also reckon because she's coming here in June, the UK, the online traffic for Taylor Swift is probably going to take a hike in the UK specifically, because until now it's been quite like US focused, but UK Swifties are going to be on that. Then the second thing is that a job advert for a Taylor Swift superfan advisor has gone live at the Victoria and Albert Museum. I thought that was really odd. So
that is odd.
Okay, so if you go on the V&A vacancies, they actually have lots of superfan advisor roles going. You can be a superfan advisor on Crocs. You can be a superfan advisor on drag.
Okay, so it's not like just a Taylor Swift phenomenon.
No, you can also be a superfan advisor on emojis. So
that makes me feel less weird about it.
Anyway, so these two things made me think, my God, the Taylor Swift hype has reached its peak.
Yeah, it's actually inescapable at the moment, isn't it? We've been saying this for a while to each other. God, we are going to have to talk about Taylor Swift on the podcast, aren't we? It's becoming too much of an elephant in the room for us to just keep not covering her. Also, I do think Travis Kelce is hot. Not the point, I know, but I am quite loving that relationship. The little video of them dancing together after the Super Bowl at the after party was actually adorable.
Can you dance to your own music in a non-tragic way? Question for the
floor. If your partner is being so cute about it, I think you can, yeah.
Yeah, it's true. So what I find interesting is that I think when you become that famous, it is A, unsustainable, B, scary in the sense of what happens when it stops. Like, I am worried about someone like Taylor Swift in terms of when the applause ends, when that level of celebrity ends, like, what happens?
But don't you just think it never will? She's just going to be the next kind of J-Lo, Madonna, Kylie type, and she's going to keep going well into her 60s and probably be performing till she retires.
I think she's definitely going to keep going, but not to this level. In the same way that, like, J-Lo, like, I don't think J-Lo has sustained the level of interest that she had when she was in, you know, 2003. Maybe it's had a resurgence because of Ben Affleck now, but that will die down again.
See, I would have disagreed with you up until doing our special the other week, because I've always seen her as the pinnacle of celebrity. But doing our research into the deep dive, I saw that actually her career really has had peaks and troughs.
Yes.
Which I wouldn't have personally picked up on without actually going into the nuts and bolts of her various successes and failures.
And I do think that J-Lo's fan base can't even compare to Taylor Swift's. Like,
no,
the mobilization of Taylor Swift's fan base is insane. Like, Ticketmaster actually released a statement that I just thought was so interesting in terms of just how massive Taylor Swift is. So when Ticketmaster completely crashed during the Eras Tour ticket sales, which, by the way, also led for Taylor Swift fans to hire their own personal lawyer to take Ticketmaster to court, which again is kind of just unprecedented in terms of like the mobilization of a fan base.
Yeah, it's that actual community organizing that's really unusual, isn't it? Yeah, they're able to actually all come together and get shit done.
It's actually very inspiring, but also scary, because that's a positive, and Ticketmaster should have been taken to court, and it's really fucking badass and amazing that they did that. But then if that amount of power is put towards a toxic aim, then that is actually really scary. So Ticketmaster put out a statement after all the controversy with the sales, saying, based on the volume of traffic to our site, Taylor would need to perform over 900 stadium shows, almost 20 times the number of shows she is doing, That's a stadium show every single night for the next 2.5 years. Like, that just blows my mind. That is what she would have had to be doing to keep up with the demand. Already, she'd already sold 2 million tickets. And just a recap, she was Time's Person of the Year in 2023. At 34 years old, she's built an empire of over 1 billion. She has already grossed, I think, like 1.4 billion from this Eras Tour, which means it's the most lucrative and successful of all time, bigger than Elton John. I think that, therefore, once you get to a certain level of cultural domination and adoration, hate starts to bubble. And I am noticing that at the moment.
See, I've noticed that always. I think there's been a real dislike of Taylor Swift since she came onto the scene as a little fresh-faced teenager. There's always been Taylor Swift haters.
Yes, I think there have been Taylor Swift haters, but I actually think that her fan base has grown so extensively that it now like encapsulates like the dads and the mums. Like, her fan base is more diverse than it's ever been.
I did love all the Taylor Swift dad coverage last year. It was very sweet, wasn't it?
I do think that she has converted a lot of haters, particularly in the last 5 years.
I guess that's sort of reflective of what we've just been saying about our own feelings on Taylor.
Absolutely. I would say that as a songwriter and a businesswoman, I am in awe of her.
I just used to be not interested in her. And now I think, you love her or hate her, you can't not find it fascinating.
Yes.
Like you say, what she says about the culture of celebrity.
I think you're right, though. I think there has always been a resentment towards Taylor Swift, as there is towards any successful woman in the industry.
Well, also, she has had some quite bad PR moments. Like when the whole Kanye and Kim thing happened, which nearly destroyed her career at the time. So just as a little recap, guys, if you can't remember, there was loads of drama between Kim Kardashian, Kanye and Taylor Swift, which reached its peak in 2016 because Kanye released Famous off his Life of Pablo album, and there was jabs at Taylor in there. Taylor basically said that it was misogynistic and that she hadn't given his blessing. Kim then claimed that Taylor knew of West's plans to release the track, and she infamously leaked an edited phone call between Kanye and Taylor discussing the song before its release. And Taylor was completely derided as a snake, as inauthentic. Again, 2016, it was around the time that people thought perhaps she was this secret Trump supporter and that she wouldn't kind of put her money where her mouth is, so to speak, and actually stand up for anything. And that's what I really didn't like about her. I was like, you're clearly just some kind of like manipulative bitch that's not actually ever going to stand for anything, that's more fussed about making money than actually doing any good in the world.
So interesting, isn't it? Because I don't know how I feel about, does a celebrity need to stand for something? It's always a question I ask myself, actually.
Whereas I did have more respect for her, as I said earlier, watching the documentary and seeing why she tactically chosen not to speak
exactly
out, rather than it being because she was a secret Trump supporter.
One of the reasons I didn't like Taylor Swift was exactly what you're saying. I also found the way that she wrote that song about Kanye West called Innocent in 2010, very problematic white feminism. So again, in context, in 2009, Kanye did something very bad. He stormed onto the VMA stage when Taylor Swift was accepting an award and was like, I'm gonna let you finish. But this award should have gone to Beyonce.
It was so awkward. Go away and watch that clip if you haven't seen it.
He literally took the mic off her and then handed it back. It was excruciating, and he should not have done that, even though he was probably right. But the point being is that Taylor Swift is humiliated on stage, and the gender dynamics, regardless of race, were clear. However, what then became a bit racially problematic, I would say, was that then Taylor Swift released the next year a song called Innocent that she publicly said was dedicated to Kanye West, where she essentially benevolently forgave him. Some of the lyrics said were, it's all right, just wait and see. Your string of lights are still bright to me. Who you are is not who you've been. You're still an innocent.
Oh, come on.
And I think there was a segment of cultural criticism that felt like a white woman savior, like pardoning the black man. Yeah. And it was up to her to like absolve him.
I do think that around that time, she presented as a kind of Southern Belle.
Yes.
And it was very much
that played into it.
White female fragility that just felt insincere and annoying. And I think that I used to see her as this kind of bastion of privilege in America that was just annoying.
Absolutely. And I also do think the Nicki Minaj beef really added to this. In 2015, Nicki Minaj went off because Anaconda wasn't nominated for an MTV Video Music Award. And I think a lot of people felt that that video was one of the dominating videos of 2015. Everyone was doing the dance routine. It was viral. And she tweeted, "If your video celebrates women with very slim bodies, you will be nominated for Vid of the Year." Taylor Swift, who had been nominated for Bad Blood, which, if we remember, had featured the Her squad, took this as personal offense. Now, I would say reading that tweet that Nicki is very much calling out the industry of yeah. what America values. She's not personally calling out Taylor Swift. What Taylor Swift should have done with that tweet is been like, yes, I agree with you, Nicki. Let me lend my platform and my voice yes. to you instead.
She's just always defensive about things, isn't she?
She has a real victim mindset. Yeah. She replied saying, "I've done nothing but love and support you. It's unlike you to pit women against each other. Maybe one of the men took your slot." That was another bad moment.
Yeah,
for
this
PR.
Is actually reminding me now why I didn't like her.
Yes, and Katy Perry chimed in saying, "Finding it ironic to parade the pit women against other women argument about as one unmeasurably capitalizes on the takedown of a woman." And of course, what she's referencing here is that Bad Blood, Taylor Swift's song, was about her feud with Katy Perry.
Okay, in my mind, I was thinking that Bad Blood was about the Kim and Kanye feud, but it was
no.
Katy. God, she's been feuding left, right and center.
She's been feuding. So in a Rolling Stone cover story, Swift said that Bad Blood was written about a fellow female pop star a year after Perry had supposedly poached three of her dancers from Red World Tour to bring on her own California Dreams Tour. So Swift said in the article, "For years, I was not sure if we were friends or not. She would come up to me at award shows and say something and walk away, and I would think, are we friends or did she just give me the harshest insult of my life?" She then goes on to say that the artist did something so horrible and that it wasn't even about a guy, it had to do with business. Basically, she tried to sabotage an entire arena tour, and she goes into, as I say, the like poaching of dancers.
Is poaching dancers sabotaging an entire arena tour? As in, I don't know. I don't know about the intricacies of booking dancers for arena tours, but is that literally a career-ending move from a fellow pop star? Wouldn't it be quite normal that the top-tier dancers move around in terms of whose camps they're in?
So from what I remember Katy Perry doing an interview about this. She left it a while, but then she did give her side of the story. And she was like, "I wasn't like purposely trying to sabotage Taylor Swift's tour. It's more that these dancers had originally worked with Katy Perry, but she basically gave them a heads up whilst they were working with Taylor Swift, being like, maybe amend your contracts or make sure that your contracts allow you to end at a certain point, because just FYI, I'm going to be starting up my tour again in X number of months. So if you want to come back and work with me, just like make sure your contract allows you to do that." Which okay. I think is kind of fair. Like if they were dancing for you originally, then went to Taylor Swift's
Taylor
tour.
Just being a victim again there.
So, but I also think, and this is one of the reasons why I didn't like her, was because I felt it was very high school mean girl to essentially get your like squad of girls to be in a video called Bad Blood yeah. about a pop star that is so, like, you have gone to town telling interviewers as much detail as you possibly can without revealing the name, but it's so clear who it is, because Katy Perry tweeted straight after the Rolling Stone interview saying, "Watch out for the Regina George in sheep's clothing, dot,
ooh,
dot, dot."
Yeah. Mean girls.
I mean, okay, yes, conceivably I do reckon that maybe you wouldn't know it was necessarily Katy Perry had Katy Perry not tweeted that. So I do think Katy Perry does bear some responsibility to like revealing that it's her by tweeting that. But I think it was also obvious because Katy Perry had been like part of the squad and then she disappeared. Like Katy Perry was her really good friend and they were like all over each other on social media and then it just like stopped. So I don't know. I think Taylor Swift knew exactly what she was doing by giving as much information as she could to journalists without revealing the exact name. And then you make a whole song about that person with the like clout of all these other incredibly successful women like Carly Kloss and whatever.
Blake Lively.
Was she in the video as well? Yeah.
Well, I know that Blake's like generally in her girl squad.
I don't know if she was in the video, but yeah, the video was much of the heft of the squad. And it does feel like bullying. It feels like ganging up on one person.
There's just something quite bitchy and immature around all of that, you know? I don't know. I think it just feels a little bit unsavoury. But I now do wonder, how much of this dislike that we're talking about that we felt towards Taylor because of these various incidences are actually in part to do with the way that hyper-successful women are always kind of maligned in the press? Like, is the fact that she's unlikable because she's so successful? I don't know.
I definitely think that is definitely part of it.
Or is it because she's actually just a bitch and annoying? I don't know. I really don't know enough about her. This is the problem. My Taylor Swift knowledge is pretty substandard.
But I do think that she does lean into a kind of...
There's a mean girl thing going on there. Like, I'm the leader of the cool crew. Thing.
Yes. And yeah. I do think one of the main reasons why I've never been able to get into Taylor Swift's music is this focus on the past, the girl era. Is it the era of the girl is something that's really associated with Taylor Swift?
Yeah, I would have, like, when I was, I don't know, 18, 19, and she was really popping off with, what's that? What's her main song? Like, Marry Me, Juliet, you'll never have to be alone.
Yes.
Oh, Love Story.
Oh, Love Story, that's it.
Like, when she was popping off with Love Story, I would have been so embarrassed to listen to her music. You know, artists like Taylor Swift or Harry Styles or whoever were just so deeply uncool in my own little cultural sphere that I would never have fathomed that someone of my age and a self-respecting music fan would be like, I love Taylor Swift. And that whole perception was completely shattered when I started working in music journalism and I realized just how many people actually love these massive artists and that actually it's not inherently uncool to like major A-list pop stars, which definitely was what I'd kind of internalized prior to that. I only listened to underground music, to UK music, or I don't know, not the kind of conventional pop by any stretch.
See, I had the opposite experience at uni. All my friends loved Taylor Swift and they all thought I was a freak for not liking her. And they'd always be like, oh, Ellie thinks she's so cool with her music taste, blah, blah, blah. I hated it. I hated all that kind of like, oh, nostalgic romance, let me talk about my boyfriend. Partly because I hadn't had any ex. Like, I hadn't had an ex.
See, I always thought of it as little girl music. Yeah. At that time, I was like, I would have loved this when I was like 9. There was that whole piece that we've talked about years ago on air because it's a really good example of celebrity journalism by Laura Snapes, who goes to Taylor's house in, is it in Dallas? It's somewhere in Texas. And she's even got like this bird cage and it's all like a pink fever dream of glitter and literally girlhood kind of realized. Do you remember that piece?
I do remember that piece. 7 years old. Yes, absolutely. I think the idea of girlhood and the fact that Taylor Swift represents a white girlhood has become a bone of contention, particularly recently.
Yeah, I've actually seen quite a lot of stuff popping up on Threads, weirdly. So I don't really go on Threads, full disclosure, but you know how Threads come up now in your Instagram feed?
Yeah.
And I've seen quite a lot of Taylor hate of late, specifically about her privilege. So I've seen a viral post pointing towards her parents, which I didn't know about. Maybe they touched on it in the documentary, but I didn't realize quite how hothouse for success she actually was and how much support she had from parents that were actually very wealthy and connected and were able to help their daughter launch this incredible career at 16. So one of the posts I saw pointed to the fact that in 2003, her parents had her a website made. This was at the point where you couldn't use platforms like Wix. You know, you couldn't manually make yourself a website. You had to literally employ a web developer and it cost a shit ton of money. Her parents did that for her.
Yes. So her mother, Andrea, was into marketing and she created a MySpace page and a website while she was still unknown. And it was really a really smart move because it meant that when Swift came to release her debut album in 2006, the fans were able to come through that MySpace and the album went platinum.
Yes, they knew what they were doing. They were tactical about it. And her dad, Scott, is like a stockbroker turned vice president for Merrill Lynch. These are upper echelons of society people. She's not the kind of country bumpkin that I think maybe they wanted to position her as when she was a teenager, like just this kid with a guitar coming up in all the country music bars in Nashville.
Yes, and I think her dad owns a stake in Big Machine Records, which was her record label. I actually think, from what I remember, that Big Machine Records didn't exist until her dad put a lot of money into it. So there's literally an article saying, did Taylor Swift's dad buy her music career?
I'm just looking at this now on Quora. The question is, did Taylor Swift's dad buy her career? And the answer is, her father reportedly purchased between 3% and 5% stake in Big Machine Records while she was recording her first album. People obviously point to the fact as well that not only could they fund her career startup, they also had the financial flexibility to pick up and move the whole family to Nashville just to make her career happen.
Yes. I mean, I'm always hesitant to say that just because you have privilege doesn't mean you have talent. Like, she couldn't have done it without talent. She also has a lot of talent.
100%.
Like, she wouldn't be who she is, like, as successful as she is now without her own talent.
No, and she's undeniably a great songwriter. She's got a lovely voice. She's clearly an enigmatic performer. Apparently, her live shows are just incredible.
Incredible.
I would actually really like to go one just to see if I would be converted to be a Swiftie.
I'm definitely going to go in June. And also,
can you bring me? If you get plus one, please bring me.
I actually have already promised it to the biggest Swiftie of all time, okay, my friend Cleo. Fair. Who does,
I'll allow that.
I literally promised her like 2 years ago. I am so sorry.
No, that's okay.
But maybe
fair.
You can get a press ticket.
Maybe. We'll report back, guys.
We'll report back, guys. We might have to fight to the death. Cleo versus Kathleen.
But don't worry, Cleo. I'll let you have it if you're listening.
She will be listening. So to kind of contextualize my point earlier about the idea of Taylor Swift hate growing now, I do think what we saw before was that Taylor Swift was constantly getting into kind of semi-scandals that created a lot of bad PR.
Oh, I've just realized we have talked about Taylor Swift on this podcast because we talked about the quite bad PR moment that was her short-lived relationship with Matty Healy.
Yes, you're right. And actually, I remember thinking that her then very calculated collaboration with Ice Spice was a highly exploitational PR move.
Yeah.
Let's get into that in a sec. It felt icky. But I think to contextualize my earlier comment about the idea that Taylor Swift is only more recently getting hate, I think maybe I mean within her own fan base. There's been a lot of criticism of her private jet use, of the fact that she has like sent the full force of her legal team down on that poor college student that like tracks private jets.
Yeah, I feel like that's really not a good look.
It's not a good look. And like, he's literally doing something that's good for the future of the planet. So he's not harassing you. He's not stalking you. And they hit her legal team was basically like, oh, it means that she's like unsafe.
Yeah, I saw that.
And I was like,
No, you just don't want to be criticized for your flagrant selfishness, actually.
Exactly. And that legal letter came like hot off the heels after it was reported that her private jet usage was like hugely...
She's like the number one climate criminal, even more so than Kylie Jenner and the like.
And she's done a lot of carbon offsetting when you put a lot of money towards offsetting your carbon footprint. But there is so much research to show that carbon offsetting is just a big scam and doesn't do anything. Like, you can plant more trees, but that absolutely does not eradicate the fact that it shouldn't be in the ozone layer to begin with.
Also, I've seen quite a lot of hate from within the Swiftie community about just how greedy she really is.
Yes.
And this kind of taps into that. Like, she is constantly trying to squeeze money out of her fans, whether that's releasing extended versions that in fact only have one song different, or whether that's like her merch. Basically, I think there's definitely a feeling within her fans that she is trying to milk them dry. And I just don't think that that is a good... look.
Agree. Yeah, it's interesting because is she trying to milk them dry, or is she very aware of how greedy the Swiftie community is just for content? Like, even I think Shameless Media were talking about it in their 5-part Taylor Swift special, which I did listen to, which they said was like their most downloaded ever. Again, just shows to like the demand is there. I think they got something like 700,000 downloads for their parts 1 and 2. They were saying how like part of, because they're both Swifties, huge Swifties, so like the part of the excitement is the fact there's always something coming. Being a Swiftie isn't so much even the release itself, it's the fact that there's always something to look forward to and to like be part of a community about.
Yeah, and I get that. And I think one of the most compelling things about her music are the Easter eggs, and that you know it's deeply personal, and that the fans can go away and kind of investigate.
Exactly. So I do wonder sometimes, okay, is she doing it to get more money, or is she doing it because she knows that's what the fans want? They always want more stuff from her.
Well, I feel like it was maybe even the Shameless Girls that touched on this, that her announcement of her new album at the Grammys was actually classically incredibly selfish and centering herself in a situation that actually could have been about all these other artists who are also winning on the night. And she makes the biggest talking point of the night, her album announcement.
So true.
Bit questionable.
It is a bit questionable. And I also do think that as she has become this inescapable cultural powerhouse that is like literally shaping culture, society, politics, I think that is also prompting people to be more critical of her, because you have to criticize and you have to be wary of anything that is that powerful.
Yeah, for
you
sure.
Have to.
1 in 5 Americans literally think that she is involved in a conspiracy to manipulate the election. Like, that's relevant for everyone.
Exactly. And so going back to this idea of the girlhood, which I find really interesting, because like, again, I keep saying this, is like, I think that's what was quite alienating to me. And clearly it sounds like it was what was alienating to you. And I'm coming at it from a white, straight perspective, I can't imagine how much more alienating that could be in terms of that, like, white girlhood to fans of colour or queer fans. So Anne Helen Peterson wrote in her Substack culture study titled Taylor Swift and the Good Girl Trap, her success is so wrapped up in all that connects to whiteness, thinness and class, particularly when it comes to her personification of girlhood. The Atlantic dubbed her the architect and figurehead of the era of the girl, which also includes things like hot girl walks and girl dinners.
Yeah, girl dinner, girl maths, girl this, girl that.
Yeah, exactly. And every time I see her like going out for dinner with Blake Lively, even though like she has every right to go out for dinner with Blake Lively and Blake Lively is genuinely her friend, and why should Taylor Swift just like coop herself up in her apartment because she's too famous to go outside? I actually think that's incredibly empowering and I respect her for that. But there is something so annoying and
icky. It
feels
contrived sometimes. Yeah. If they're holding hands, you're like...
They're holding hands!
You're a 34-year-old woman. Do you need to hold hands going into a restaurant? I mean, can you imagine you and I strolling on into a bar holding hands? Like, no.
That's what it is.
It forms a friendship. And I always feel like that with her whole crew, the Gigi Hadids and the Blakes and everyone. Are you genuinely besties, or is this in part like something that you want to project into the world?
Yes, and I do think that that kind of performative friendship has been since the very start, the origins of the squad. That's what pissed some people off. Yeah. It's like, why do you need to have this weird squad? Like, it feels so performative. And also, I didn't like the way that, like, depending on how, like, in favour you were with Taylor Swift, like, girls would drop in and out of the squad. Like, yeah. What the hell happened to Lena Dunham? Carly Cross? Like, Katy Perry is now back, quite, is, like, back in favour because she was seen, like, at the Eras Tour dancing to Bad Blood.
Katy was.
Yeah. And Carly Kloss has also been seen at the Eras Tour. And I do wonder sometimes whether that's like Taylor Swift inviting them because they were...
It's a PR move.
Yeah.
Well, she's always a name that comes up when people talk about PR relationships. Tom Hiddleston, some people argue that that was an entire fake setup.
I am still totally perplexed by that, because I would say, looking back, okay, she clearly has a thing for a British guy, and you know, she has had a lot of boyfriends. Why would that one be fake necessarily over the others? But it was the Taylor Swift, I love Taylor Swift t-shirt that threw me. It was like, why would you wear that? And
surely
also
not.
I don't see Tom Hiddleston as this like hilarious, sardonic irony man.
No.
If Matty Healy wore an I love TS,
you'd know he's taking the piss.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're shagging.
Even though people are now saying that perhaps that relationship was a kind of fuck you at Joe Alwyn. Like, she went for this incredibly inappropriate partner because she was in fact really hurt by something that had gone down with Joe Alwyn.
It
was a public revenge
move.
That's
so interesting. Yeah, I do feel that like maybe she has lost the boundaries between
public
her private self and her public self, and everything can be used as PR. And like, even I do feel slightly conflicted about Joe Alwyn clearly being the fodder for her new album. So even that, for people that don't know, many fans think is a reference to the fact that Joe Alwyn, the guy who she was with for I think 7 years and recently broke up with, and Paul Mescal, who she hasn't dated, have a group text called the Tortured Man Club. And her album's called The Tortured Poets Department. Considering that Joe Alwyn is probably going to drive a lot of her new songs, considering they just had a breakup, is that not clearly a coded reference to that WhatsApp group?
Could well be. I think quite a few of the songs have these kind of coded references in them as well. I feel like there's literally one called London Boy or something.
Yes. And actually, I should say, Caroline O'Donoghue, former guest of the podcast, has a fantastic two-part deep dive on Midnights.
Yeah.
And how, following the breakup with Joe Alwyn, fans have realised that actually Midnights is probably not what they thought. And it's actually a breakup album. And all the songs can be seen as reflections on how it feels to be trapped within a relationship that you don't want. Whereas I think before they thought that, like, when she was still with Joe Alwyn, it was about a previous ex. Whereas now they've realised it was probably about Joe Alwyn. And I feel quite sorry for Joe Alwyn. This is me caveating it with, so far nothing bad has come out about Joe Alwyn other than his quite terrible performance in Conversation with Friends. Like, other than seemingly potentially being a bit of a boring man, he seems fine, and I think they broke up because he couldn't deal with her fame, and that's fair.
That's the narrative at the moment among her fans, I think, is that Travis Kelce is far more suited to her because he's so happy to like be in love in public.
Oh yeah, and you know, he had his own podcast, he's like hosted SNL, like he loves the limelight. They are so compatible, whereas Joe Alwyn does not he never wanted to be famous in that way. And I don't think that should be held against him. And I worry that her having quite clearly autobiographical references to their relationship in this new album in particular just adds to that spotlight for him. I don't know. I think that's maybe quite selfish and irresponsible.
Yeah.
But then also, why should a woman curtail her creative output just for a man? You know, like, there is always a for and against. And I don't ever want to feel that, like, people think we are clipping Taylor Swift's wings.
No, and there are elements of her kind of strong feminist stance that I really admire, but I do think is exclusionary.
Exactly. So earlier this month, an article from the Huffington Post went viral. The title was, "I'm So Damn Tired of Taylor Swift." And it was by the Huffington Post's Black Voices editor, Taryn Finley. And she said, "The growing issue for me is how she's been propped up. Her brand of feminism has never felt inclusive, yet she's been praised for empowering women. Her relationship with Kelce is like any other celebrity romance, yet cameras cut to her during NFL games like she's on the sidelines calling plays. And she's received Album of the Year at the Grammys 4 times. A black woman hasn't won the honour in 25 years.
And no wonder, sorry to jump in and interrupt you, but at the Grammys this year, Jay-Z again had to reference the fact that Beyoncé never wins Album of the Year.
Yes, although I also would say that at this point, Beyoncé needs to say it herself, because two men now getting on stage on her behalf. Like,
but then she'd look bitter if she was like, "I didn't win and I should have," you know?
I know, but then I would just assume that she's briefed her husband.
But it's so boring that Taylor Swift wins every sort of year.
Again, yeah, I totally agree. But should Renaissance have won Album of the Year?
I do love Renaissance as an album, but I think by far Beyoncé's strongest body of work was Lemonade. It actually shocks me to my core to this day that she didn't win Album of the Year for that. What the fuck?
Yeah.
It's just so
with you there.
Unfathomable.
I just find it slightly cringe, another guy speaking on behalf of Beyoncé again at another award show. There's just something a bit like, I would just rather Beyoncé made her own statement on her own social media or something, because it's correct. I just wish it would come from her. So then Taryn Finley continues, "More than just a critique of Swift, this is about how she's talked about, covered in media, and lauded by institutions. The blonde white woman is seen as America's gold standard. That doesn't sit right with me. The fact that she leans into it doesn't sit right with me either."
Hear, hear, Taryn.
Yes, and I do think it's really interesting to see the way fandom is completely dictating the rules of the media now. I actually wrote about this in my newsletter called "Fandom Has the Media in a Chokehold," pegged to the incredibly problematic New York Times op-ed suggesting that Taylor Swift was gay.
Oh, that was bizarre.
So Anna Marks, who is the opinion editor of the New York Times, the international paper of record, published a 4,000-word essay suggesting that Taylor Swift was actually gay, her relationship with Kelce was a lie, and went through all of her work to look for all the kind of queer Easter eggs that backed up Anna Marx's argument, and said that she was just too scared to come out as a queer hero, but that she was a queer hero that
just
we all needed.
Such a projection.
It's such a projection. It was, I think I said in my newsletter, like a Tumblr essay from the Gayla subreddit community, which is
What's
actually quite huge.
Subreddit?
Essentially all the queer readings that you could possibly imagine of Taylor Swift's work, as in
Gayla. Taylor, yeah, but yeah, yeah. Got it, sorry.
Had been just published by a major newspaper. It was so weird. It was
unhinged.
It's unhinged. And I found that very distressing, because I was like, oh my God, I don't feel like editors have control over their own publications anymore. I think they
the
are...
The New York Times is a cesspit though, right?
It
Everyone
has become
is
a,
saying that.
But I do think with that in particular, they were like, sure, the Swifties, like, let's feed the Taylor Swift machine. All our Taylor Swift content does really well. This is probably the only angle we haven't covered yet. That Taylor Swift is actually secretly gay. Let's publish that.
Yeah.
It's really depressing. So to finish, I just want to think about where the hell Taylor Swift can go from here. I just don't know how this level of celebrity is sustainable. And Anne Helen Peterson wrote in her Substack, again, called Culture Study, as I said earlier, "When a celebrity is that prominent, they are always in danger of becoming the figurehead of cultural and societal frustrations, which is one of the many reasons celebrities periodically recede from the public eye. No matter how many people love you, there comes a point when the structure of a star image cannot shoulder the weight of the star's meaning and import." And I think that is where we've got to with Taylor Swift.
Well, we needed to do some Taylor Swift coverage. So here you go, guys. Let us know. Are you a Swiftie? Are you not? Let's make that our poll this week.
Ooh,
how
yes.
How many listeners are actually Swifties?
That would be really interesting.
Right, Hans, who else here feels inexplicably overwhelmed by a silent rage at the sound of somebody loudly crunching on crisps at their desk?
Or heavy breathing like a wounded wildebeest.
Oh, or snivelling incessantly on the tube.
Or clacking their acrylic nails on a keyboard.
Ah!
I mean, we could go on, couldn't we, babe? But no, you are not a psychopath. If common sounds make you feel suddenly furious, you might just have something called misophonia.
Yeah, so to explain, guys, our ears are shaped like shells, so the sound we receive is actually always distorted about 20%. Most people's brains filter that out, but if you're like Els and I, then you're going to need a bit of a helping hand, and you have to get yourself a pair of Karma earbuds from our absolute faves at Flare Audio.
They have stopped severe bouts of violence. They are so tiny, comfy, and super unobtrusive. Much better than noise-cancelling headphones, which shut you off from sounds you actually need to hear. And don't just take our word for it. They've sold 2 million pairs since the launch in lockdown.
Yeah, and even if you don't have misophonia, they can help with so many annoying and sharp sounds to just take the edge off, help keep you calm. You know, if you're working in a cafe, something like that, you've got to head to Flare Audio to get your pair now for $19.95.
Thank you to Flare. By the way, Kath, we haven't yet told the Huns about our Galentine's night at Cole, Miss Korea.
Oh my God, we actually haven't. And any of the tequila and mezcal loving honeys, fellow margarita lovers out there, need to know about Cole because it's just so good, isn't it?
So bloody
genuinely
good.
Genuinely love that spot. So if you don't know, guys, Cole is a really, really popular, well-known, like fine dining Mexican restaurant in the heart of London. It's from well-known Mexican-born chef Santiago Lastra. He is kind of famous, I guess, because he was involved in the Noma pop-up in Mexico. So you know Noma being the world-class restaurant. I want to say, is it in Copenhagen, Denmark?
Yes.
And
that was satirized by the menu.
Exactly. It's meant to be the kind of most ridiculous, like, pinnacle of the fine dining world. It's actually closed. But Santiago has had kind of, his career has gone from strength to strength. Cole is super popular. I think he's actually opening a new restaurant soon. But while we have not eaten in the restaurant, the Mezcaleria in the basement is so vibey. And having been to Mexico myself, I'm going back again in a mere 2 weeks.
And so am I.
Yeah.
After you.
So you know that the Mezcaleria is meant to be based on Oaxacan bars. And
yes.
Oaxaca is the place where I'm going back to, that you're going also.
Yes.
It's personally my favourite bit of Mexico because it's like the less, I want to say, maybe Americanized part.
Yes. The Caribbean coast is very Florida.
Exactly, which is the Cancun side, whereas Oaxaca is on the
Pacific
West coast. Yeah, and oh, we saw whales, we saw dolphins. It's like more wild, and it's the big food capital of Mexico.
I'm literally following your itinerary. You were like, yeah, you must go to Oaxaca.
I need to set, like, your exact
Oaxaca city
spots.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that more another
we'll
time.
We'll do that.
Because I just want to say how genuinely authentic Cole Mezcaleria actually is. Like, it really does have the feel of a Oaxaca bar.
It does. And I say that having not been there, but yes. I also felt that it was very good for date night.
Oh, it's really romantic, isn't it?
All that low lighting, like moody low lighting.
But also, like, really great for friends. I think most of the other people that were in there were groups of friends.
That's
on the
true.
Night that we were there. I think what's really, really cool about the bar is just how much they celebrate mezcal. So again, in terms of authenticity, I really noticed in Mexico how mezcal is actually bigger than tequila there. It is more popular. Like, if you get a margarita, it will usually be made with mezcal. The Mezcaleria at Cole celebrates this, like, incredible breadth of spirits that are made from agave. That can be tequila also, or it can be mezcal. Mezcal is the more smoky version, essentially, of tequila, but it is also made from the agave plant. And I just love how their menu really celebrates, like, real craftsmanship, and they're interesting drinks that maybe you wouldn't have tried before.
I personally loved the Sour 17.
It was yummy, wasn't it?
It was
like a sour.
Yes, sour marg.
Because as most sustainable or eco-conscious spots now do, they're not big on the use of lemons and limes because it really is so unenvironmental. Mm. So they use citric acid and other kind of sour citrus flavorings in place of lemon and lime. It really works.
It really worked. Also, shout out for the bar snacks because our tacos were brilliant.
They are Santiago's take on traditional Mexican antojitos, but using the best of British ingredients. So like Scottish lobster or Kentish Oaxacan cheese.
Mm.
My fave when we went was defo the Wagyu tostada.
I also loved the beef short rib empanada.
Yummers.
So good. Guys, head down to Cole. That's K-O-L. It's in Marylebone.
The restaurant is such a special treat because it's a set menu. So I think going to the Mezcaleria is just a really lovely way to experience the magic of Cole without necessarily committing to what would otherwise be quite a pricey special occasion kind of option.
Exactly. Much more affordable. So enjoy that, Hans. Right, now back onto culture. Cathers, I want to hear all about the list.
Yes. So you actually lent me this book. I'm really excited to talk about it because I Loved it. So the list is the debut novel from the amazing British journalist Yomi Adegeke. It's a thoroughly zeitgeisty, intricately weaved page turner. And sorry, I know you hate the term zeitgeist, but it really is accurate in this situation. It's about the internet, cancel culture, curated lifestyles, celebrity, and also abuse. It's very nuanced and it's kind of exploring grey areas and moral dilemmas.
I love a moral grey area.
So just to give you the blurb, the novel focuses on Insta-famous couple Ola and Michael, who are due to be married in a month. Ola is a well-known feminist journalist, while Michael is a podcaster who has just landed his dream job. And they're both somewhat like Insta-famous, largely down to their relationship. So as Yomi puts it in the book, they're the king and queen of black love, and so their relationship is idealized by a large degree.
Okay.
By this audience that actually don't know them as people, but hold them up as the pinnacle of couple goals.
Yep. Feels very apt in terms of where we are culturally.
Yeah. The List, which is, of course, the name of the book, The List is an anonymous online kind of collection of 70 names of different men who have all been accused of varying forms of abuse in the media. So the point of the book is, I suppose, that the British media is having its Me Too moment. Yomi has actually said in an interview since that she first had the idea for this book in 2017. She was inspired by, of course, Harvey Weinstein allegations, the Me Too movement. She felt that it was slightly maybe too of the time to write it back then. And so she wanted to give it a bit of distance and a bit of room for conversation. What I really like about the book's kind of standpoint is that it's this very intelligent, critical, but left-leaning look at cancel culture, because she does make the point, and I think this is really important, that it's unusual for progressive people to engage with conversations around cancel culture in a critical way. So, and I'll quote Yomi here, it's very rarely something that progressive people are discussing in a critical way and looking at. The idea, for instance, of innocence till proven guilty is a kind of core tenet of left-wing thinking and progressivism. And I think often when you say cancel culture, people immediately think it's a dog whistle for right-wing thinking or something like that. But I wanted to talk about it from a feminist perspective and say, look, this book is first and foremost about the internet and how the internet can, because of complete unbridled access by anyone, be weaponized and weaponize the most well-meaning of movements.
So true. Okay.
So the book's told from both Ola and Michael's perspective. So you really get a sense of both of their journeys, and you kind of don't sit on the fence too strongly either way. Like, no one is made out to be the kind of hero or the victim of the book. It's more complicated than that. And I think that's what's so brilliant. And that's what Yomi really achieves, is this nuance. By the way, if you don't know, it is her first novel, but she has written books before. She co-authored the seminal Slay in Your Lane, which was like a black girl's manual to the working world, which was published in July 2018. And actually, she does kind of bring that narrative forward into this book, in that I love not only her evisceration of the working world, but also it really is a beautiful kind of depiction of the Black British community, particularly the African diaspora.
That's good. Okay, how? Tell me how.
So Ola is of Nigerian descent, while Michael, her fiancé, is Ghanaian. And the book actually is kind of predicated, as I said, around their wedding. So they have this huge wedding plan that's going to have hundreds of guests, that's going to be a mishmash of both their cultures, and that's going to just be this kind of aspirational moment. As I touched on earlier, they are Insta famous as a couple. I think she really does depict the kind of Black British experience in such a genuinely authentic way, whether it's looking at microaggressions in the workplace. So Yomi has said that her favorite character to write was Frankie, who is the white woman that runs the intersectional feminist publication Woman that Ola works at. And it is such an on point caricature, I think. Frankie seems so true.
I mean, the very fact that a white woman is running an intersectional feminist network is, I guess, also part of the parody, right?
Yeah, exactly, because she kind of embodies all the hypocrisies of what a woman like her trying to be woke really is, talking about wanting someone with a disability on the cover because she knows it'll drive clicks.
Oh, God.
You know, very problematic, but cloaked in this idea of progressivism. So Yomi really does encapsulate the reality of our media landscape in a very funny way. She gives kind of fake names to institutions that we would probably recognise.
So okay.
Webby Awards in the book are the Netties.
Yeah.
Webbies versus Netties, internet.
Yeah.
That's what I took from it anyway. Curated definitely speaks to other online platforms that already exist. There's a website called All Tea and No Crumpets,
okay,
which is very clearly meant to be Shade Borough. So she kind of satirizes these recognizable publishing
outlets.
Outlets, exactly.
So Curated is meant to be Joram Daily or SVTV.
Yeah, it's got that vibe. So yeah, I think Yomi is particularly incisive when she's looking at the world of work, which would make a lot of sense based on her previous work. But what actually really spoke to me about the book, that's almost like a side note, because what is really, really interesting about the book generally is this nuance around moral decisions, particularly when you associate yourself as a kind of progressive person, a feminist, you know, you see yourself as someone that fights for good. Well, what do you do when those problems come into your own backyard, I suppose, is the moral dilemma.
Such a good point.
So the titular list really is brought up within several pages. The first chapter sees Michael and Ola having a fun night out drunk, and then the following chapter, which is like 27 days until their wedding that they've spent £20,000 on and have hundreds of people coming to, and is meant to be this kind of big Insta moment as well as a big in real life celebration. A list of 70 different men's names is published online with varying forms of abuse listed next to them. Michael's name is one of them. So Michael is listed as being abusive, having harassed someone and having a restraining order against
him. So having physically harassed someone?
Yeah, but it's what's kind of interesting about the allegations against Michael is that they're vague. So this is the conundrum that Ola is in. She is this out and proud feminist working at Woman magazine who's wrote hundreds of articles about misogyny, about abuse. She's actually written quite a similar piece prior. So a few years previously, she'd done a kind of expose on abusive men within a certain industry. And her editor, in fact, wants her to write about the list.
So on
the day that the list comes out and she sees Michael's name is on there, her editor is oblivious to that and is like, you need to do a deep dive investigation into the list now. And she's like completely morally torn, obviously, because her fiance, her love of her life, is literally listed there, but she's meant to be a champion for women and she's meant to believe victims. And so what does she do when he's swearing blind that he didn't abuse anyone and that someone's put his name on that list because they're like out to get him?
God, that is so difficult. I've actually seen that in previous places I've worked with. If people are on the news desk, they may have, and also I guess you imagine that people who work in journalism to begin with are probably quite well connected and quite privileged. I've seen people who work on the news desk of newspapers who have had to write news articles or who have had their close colleagues write news articles about like friends and family.
Yeah, people they know.
Yeah, it's so difficult.
Yeah, and I think that's why Ola's narrative is at the centre of the book, but equally it's also told from Michael's perspective, so that you, again, it's that kind of exploration of the grey area. Yomi has said in an interview, we all think we know what we would do if we were in a position like that, i.e. Ola's position. And the minute someone adjacent to you, suddenly your whole sense of self, your whole sense of morality is thrown into question. So I wanted people to look at Ola and question, what would I actually do? Not what I tweet what I'd do, but what I'd actually do if it was
me. Fuck me. What would you do, babe?
I really don't know, because that's what is so compelling about the book. You go with Ola on this journey of completely unraveling as a person. Like, her sense of self is destroyed by this. Because suddenly she's like, how can I marry up my lifelong feminist beliefs and my job and my self-worth and my identity and everything that comes with that, particularly being a journalist who writes about those issues as her career, but also then stand by a man who's been... It actually kind of reminded me of Lena Dunham's most dickhead move. Do you remember this? I think it's the biggest scandal that she's probably had. And it's when she really did start to fall from grace, I suppose, as a feminist icon. And it was when she and Jennifer A. Kona, who was her co-writer on Girls, went public basically denying one woman's allegations of abuse.
Yes!
Because they knew the man.
Oh my God.
It was honestly the most shocking, backwards,
blinkered,
like crazy thing for Lena Dunham to have done when she's built her entire brand on being a staunch feminist.
Yeah.
To say, oh, believe all women apart from this one woman this time when it's actually my friend who's being accused.
It's wild. Really, really even awful. If you weren't a celebrity, it would be wild. Like, just in terms of quite clear personal prejudice.
So obviously in the book, both Michael and Ola are not only grappling with the fallout from the list and everything that comes with it, but also there's this question of why Michael's on the list in the first place.
So do you ever get that answer?
Yes, you do. Michael's adamant that he didn't do anything wrong, but he's not a saint. He's a kind of toxic guy. Well, he's a toxic guy who's done some really shady shit. He didn't do what he's accused of, but does that negate the fact that he's done something wrong in the first place? You know what I mean? Like, it's a book about moral dilemmas. There's no like easy answers. As Yomi says, if we leave it to right-wing pundits to talk about cancel culture critically, then essentially they own that conversation.
Oh, very good point.
Yeah. So I just hadn't seen this really nuanced exploration of cancel culture and how important it is that victim stories are being heard, with equally how online kind of Twitter pitchfork activity can get out of hand being talked about in this way. And I can see why the book has been such a success, because it is the first novel that I've heard of to really reckon with these issues.
Yes, and this is a generalization, but I do think there is something to the fact that the people that are most vocal taking down other people in terms with their kind of ideological principles are often the ones who actually have the most to be ashamed of themselves.
Yeah, and the most to hide. Like you cast the stone.
Yeah, it's because you have shame about yourself and you're scared about your own wrongdoings.
Yeah, and she looks at all elements of that spectrum. So she considers the impact on the women who didn't want something like this list to go public. So the idea was that this list was going to be sort of internally circulated amongst the media industry just for women to be able to know about other potential predators. Mm. The list then is anonymously leaked on Twitter. And Yomi looks at how the women who never thought their stories would go public are now being picked apart in comments online and questioned.
I also do think, I don't know if this happens in the list in terms of like the way that women are held to impossible standards versus their male counterparts. I could so imagine that Ola would be made to feel accountable as a feminist.
That's exactly
for
it.
Michael's wrongdoings.
That's literally exactly it. She's held up as an apologist. I don't want to go too much into any spoilers, but the amount of vitriol and hate that she gets is definitely equal, if not more, than Michael's.
Right, which is ridiculous because actually she'd be getting none of it and it should all be going to Michael.
Yeah, but I think what the book does so beautifully is that it doesn't point fingers. Like, you really see why all Michael sides. Is the way he is. And I think I loved this quote in Refinery 29 interview with Yomi. She says, the book asks uncomfortable questions essentially about what we believe online and who we all are online versus offline.
That's the thing. We're so different.
Yeah, it's a cautionary tale for the chronically online.
And also I do reckon that like when you're with someone, they may have problematic parts of themselves, but maybe the whole point of being in love is you are thinking about who they can be, who they could be eventually.
Yeah, and it totally taps into that. And Ola recognises that Michael has this real potential, but that perhaps whether it's because of his own childhood circumstances, his own parents' relationships around the kind of lad culture of his friends and
people
the WhatsApp group.
What they expect him to
maybe
be.
He's just projecting this kind of playboy image and that actually he really is a good person at heart. Yeah, it deals with all of that. I also just do think Yomi is so brave for doing a book like this. She says writing it felt like walking on a tightrope. I felt like with just one wrong move, I might too strongly veer into one side of the argument. And I think that's what she does so successfully. Another quote that I really liked, which was with ABC News, is where Yomi says, we still haven't recognized with the huge unchecked power of the internet, movements can be appropriated and taken advantage of online, but simultaneously the internet is a huge tool to give voice to the voiceless and speak truth to power. And I think that's what she does so cleverly. She doesn't discredit the victims at any point. She actually really champions movements like Me Too. You definitely can sense that this book was maybe written for TV and film in mind. I don't think
it has been picked up.
It has. So it's gone global. It's been advertised in Times Square, New York. Earlier this year, it was announced that the list is being adapted to TV by HBO Max, BBC, and A24, the cult production company that you mentioned everyone loving recently.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the US release of her book has also formed part of Spotify's launch of the app's expansion into audiobooks.
Do you know what Kata's? Unlike Sydney Sweeney's rom-com, I feel thoroughly inspired to read this book.
You have to read it. I think the only reason that I struggled a little bit with the first chapter is because I struggled with the first chapter of every book. That's actually a thing for me. Even the first chapter of Tomorrow, 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 when they're looking at the kind of visual illusion in the train station, I found that really painful. I don't know what it is. First chapters rarely hook me in. But my God, once I was into this book, I could not put it down.
Yes, on first chapters, I think it just takes so much effort to suspend disbelief. Because you just think that you're watching little puppets being...
Yeah, you're just abruptly in the world of the book and you almost feel a bit disorientated. And then my other recommendation for this week is actually very on theme, which is the latest true crime offering from Netflix.
Oh, yes.
Can I Tell You a Secret? It deals with the same themes of cyberstalking, doxing, anonymous abuse, stolen identity. Have you seen it?
I haven't, babe, but I do know that it's Shirin Carle's... adaptation of her feature article.
Exactly. So the latest true crime offering from Netflix is actually the first that has been made with Louis Theroux's Mindhouse production company, and it is in association with The Guardian. So the excellent two-parter follows a Guardian investigation into the recipient of the longest ever sentence for online stalking. But what they do so brilliantly is they focus on the victims, not the perpetrator.
Good.
So it's the story of cyberstalker Matthew Hardy, who terrorized multiple women over many years. I believe the entire number is like 62 or something crazy like that. It was the first case covered in depth by G2, by Shirin, as you say. And then there was a 6-part Guardian podcast series in 2022 on it. And that was the year that Hardy received the longest sentence handed down in the UK for online stalking ever, which is 9 years.
Okay.
The whole investigation, as Sheeran's headline put it, was 11 years, 10 arrests and at least 62 women. How did Britain's worst cyberstalker evade justice for so long? So the three women that are focused in the documentary are Abby, Zoe and Leah. And what's really sad is that they are all really like happy, attractive, confident young women that have strong online presences when they start to receive these messages from a confiding stranger, apparently female at first. And the opening gambit was often this weird line that gives the series its title. Can I tell you a secret?
Oh,
super creepy.
And what would the rest of the message say?
So there would be these exchanges. The women would generally get suspicious because it'd be like, why is this random person messaging me about, can I tell you a secret? Then the harassment would begin, and using fake profiles and posing as the women to send sexual content to like the fathers of their friends, for example, posing as people the women had met on holiday in order to message their boyfriends, start rumors and sow division. He would create like multiple, like scores of fake profiles, not only as the women, but also people she knows, to just like create chaos in their lives.
Oh my God. It's really reminding me of Sweet Bobby, where the
it's
cousin...
It's like that, but on like a huge scale. It's like Sweet Bobby, but with like multiple women and even more
fake
insane
profiles.
Essentially.
Christ alive.
Also classic, the women were all sent to their various local police forces and surprise, surprise, were fobbed off. Nothing happens. They're basically told that no crime's been committed, kind of given the impression that they bought them on themselves. One of the girls, Zoe, is... Oh, she's got like some modelling shots in a bikini online, so it's almost hinted that it's like kind of her fault. However, one officer, PC Kevin Anderson, did eventually take the matter seriously, and he's the one that started investigating it and found that Hardy had been cyberstalking women for like just about as long as he'd been on the internet, since he was like a lonely, awkward teenager. There is then this kind of whole other thing that comes out because he actually had undiagnosed autism, and the undiagnosed autism actually later saw his sentence reduced by a year. However, they of course make sure to have advocates in that space in the documentary to say, oh, it makes me uncomfortable as someone with autism for that to be almost used as an excuse, because it isn't. So they really do deal with that in a sensitive way.
Okay, yeah.
But I just think it does this excellent job of kind of marshalling all of these like facts and pivotal points into one cohesive documentary, like considering how complicated it actually is to follow with the millions of accounts, the fake names, the female personas that Matthew Hardy sometimes takes on, the males. Like,
do they reenact the personas with different voices?
Yeah, they have voices. So they've got a kind of, you know, like those distorted voices.
Yeah,
so at one point they use a man's voice and another a woman's. It's so creepy and really does encapsulate just how awful it must have been for the women. And I think that's what the documentary does really well. It speaks to the psychological unsafety that these women felt and how... Really, that's what stalking does. Like, you know, some of these women were sleeping with weapons at night. They were so afraid. He would be sending messages, oh, I can see you doing X to the car. He genuinely felt so unsafe all the time. And yet how people perceive cyberstalking minimizes that reality. They're like, oh, it's just online. And really did remind me of The List, even with the generational difference in that. In The List, Ola and Michael's family members are like, oh, it's just what's happening online. It's not the real world. Just ignore it. Whereas Michael points to the fact that even though this thing can happen on a subsection of the internet, you suddenly feel that everyone's talking about it.
Oh my God, absolutely. As I keep wanging on with my Nicki Minaj stuff, I was twitching the curtains of my Stockwell apartment, sure that these Nicki Minaj barbs, super fans.
So guys, if you don't know, Elle's just given some reference to what happened there.
I basically made a kind of probably clumsy reference to the way Cardi B was taking Nicki Minaj's crown, and the barbs got very upset, the barbs being the Nicki Minaj stans, and they just annihilated my LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, my friends' LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, email,
my
work
messages.
Email. Yeah. Just with all the unicorn emojis, basically just calling me horrendous things, horrible death threats about how like skinning and gutting my family, and saying that they were going to dox me because they had found my address on like one of my online CVs. I remember being on my own one night, I think it was like a Saturday night, the day after it happened, looking out of the curtains of my apartment, being like, oh my God, what if they're coming? Even though I knew in the rational side of my brain that these were just like bored losers who are probably like 14 years old
but
living.
Still totally spooked.
Oh yeah.
You just
totally
don't know.
Spooked.
I guess your mind can't.
I was hysterically crying for like 3 days.
What's real and what's not. And I think The List and Can I Tell You a Secret really speak to that. Like how our generation understand that what happens online is the real world, whereas our parents' generation perhaps genuinely see them as two separate spaces. There's the real world and there's the online world.
Yeah, exactly.
But for us, it's not that simple.
Well, I think a lot of parenting goes wrong when you refuse to acknowledge that the online world is actually probably the primary world of your child.
Yeah. I mean, both of these pieces of content position the internet as a very scary place.
It is scary, Cathers. I'm scared of it.
I'm a bit scared of it as well. But, you know, how do we navigate these new spaces? This is how, I guess, we'll figure it out. You know, art's all about navigating life and reflecting back to us the reality of our circumstances. And so I think these creative projects, be that novels or series, do help us as a broader society to actually compute, bit of a pun there,
yeah,
that we're talking about online, but or process and understand just how much this Wild West, as you put it earlier, is impacting our sense of self, our morality, how we show up in the world, whether we feel safe, all of those things.
Absolutely.
So that's that. I think we probably need to wrap up the episode quite soon, but I do have one lighthearted recommendation.
Oh, yes.
To follow those quite depressing themes, which is, if you want something lighthearted, silly and fun, also on Netflix, go and watch The Lost City, starring Sandra Bullock, Channing Tatum, Brad Pitt and Daniel Radcliffe. It's a lot of fun.
Is this Lost City of Zed?
No, it's called The Lost City. It's basically about a reclusive and depressed author, Loretta Sage, who is Sandra Bullock, who writes about exotic places in her popular kind of romance adventure novels that feature a handsome cover model named Alan, aka in the book, he's called Dash. He is played by Channing Tatum. They have this kind of following where obsessors of the book are really into Dash. They sort of see him as a real man. So the cover model and the character become one and the same, I suppose, in the audience's minds. So when Loretta goes to do panels and things, Dash will often be on these tour dates.
Talking of Channing Tatum, we said that we would go and see Magic Mike live and we haven't done it.
We do need to do that. So it's quite fun because it satirizes Indiana Jones. Weirdly, Brad Pitt is actually a very minor character, which you don't usually see him making those kind of appearances.
Brad Pitt, who has had a facelift.
Has he?
Yes.
Ooh.
Amy Adele, my favourite Substacker.
You always say that about every Substacker.
Sorry, I have three favourites. Yeah. Amy Adele, Jessica DeFino and
Michaela Jameson.
And Michaela Jameson as of recently. And she and Brad Pitt has had a very tasteful facelift.
Okay.
If you compare and contrast him from 5 years ago. Very good. But you can tell, apparently, one of the a British aesthetician has done a whole like TikTok dissecting why he knows he's had a facelift. You can always tell by a little scar on your ear, apparently.
Ooh, a little tuck.
Yeah.
Well, he looks very handsome, but he's not in it for that long. What happens is that while Loretta, aka Sandra Bullock, is on tour promoting the book with Alan, who is, of course, Channing Tatum / Dash, she is kidnapped by an eccentric billionaire played by Daniel Radcliffe, which
that's
feels very random.
Actually something I definitely need to see.
Who hopes that she'll be able to lead him to an ancient city's lost treasure because of her latest story. So the idea is that her erotic novel is considered silly and fluffy by most of the audience, but in fact, she tries to intellectualize it by basing it on genuine ancient scripts. The Lost City of D, I assume is meant to be like the Lost City of Dick.
Oh my God, I kind of love this.
But she's actually based D on
ancient dick.
Whereas she's talking about like an ancient civilization and only she can read the scroll. And that's why Daniel Radcliffe's character wants to kidnap her so that she can help him find this treasure. It is absurd. Alan, i.e. Channing Tatum's character, sets off to rescue her.
Does it feel erotic?
It's like PG erotic. Right. Do you know what I mean? Like it's
Daniel Radcliffe can only be.
Yes.
Actually, I say that, but he was in Equus where he was full frontal on stage.
Yeah. Stuff. No, it is definitely kind of lighthearted and fun, and it's not particularly explicit, but it's playing with the conventions of the romance novel in a really fun way.
You know what apparently is huge in fiction right now? Romanticy. The hybrid genres of romance and fantasy. So they want to see like women battling dragons, but all the while falling in love with an elf or something.
Okay, yeah. Well, this is definitely sort of touching on that in that you see these quite fun scenes where the writer considers how to change something. So at first she'll be lying there in this pit with all these snakes everywhere and he's meant to be coming to rescue her. And then she's like, no, scrap that. That doesn't feel real. And the scene changes in front of your eyes.
Ooh.
So it's messing with a like meta sense of writing,
yes,
which is probably why I like it and why I think you'll like it.
That's what they do in American Fiction when he's...
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a much lighter touch film than American Fiction. Definitely wouldn't probably put those two together, but a fun watch all the same.
Well, Cathers, that sounds thoroughly enjoyable. I will give that a spin. I will save some of my recommendations for our next episode because I think we've been tootling on for a while.
We have. Guys, if you've got any recommendations that you need us to take a look at, please do send them in. We love, 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 love hearing from you.
We should start in these episodes giving feedback on the polls. Guys, I know that most of you don't scroll down your Spotify to like actually look at the polls, but we have polls every week on Spotify. So if you're listening on Spotify, please look at the poll and vote.
We will be back next week. As always, please do rate, review and subscribe. We would be so grateful for any Apple reviews. They are really what do seem to move the needle on helping other people discover the pod. But absolutely, we are very grateful for Spotify ratings as well. You can't do written reviews there, no, as we have told many listeners now. So if you can spare just 2 seconds and you can write us a review on Apple, we will be so grateful that we might even share some more embarrassing secrets soon.
We do. We love all of our Apple reviews. The Apple reviews are so helpful. We take all constructive feedback and criticism very seriously, and we just love how cute you guys have been as well.
We do, and we love your DMs. So please keep those coming at Straight Up Pod. We will see you next time.